Have you wondered
what makes a good horn solo? Some of my French, some of my trumpet buddies are probably going, yeah, I've really wondered. I think it's one part human and the second part instrument. The human being has to have practiced. He has to have good technique. He has to know placement of the lips, what to do, what buttons to push. But if the horn is unwilling to submit to the master's playing, it'll be a very short solo, because there's only a few notes I can play on a horn without using the 3 to 4 vowels that I have. In fact, now and then there's a situation where all of a sudden I'll pick up my horn, get ready to play, and one of these keys either won't press or it won't come back up very fast, and the solo, or at least the playing in the orchestra for that day is done, unless I can exert some force on it or administer some grace to it, some oil to make the gears, that is actually the valves, less sticky. I think that's the case also in the Christian walk. What makes an effective Christian? It's one part God and one part the instrument. In fact, we serve a God who desires to play each of us beautifully, to have his life, his ruach, his breath, his spirit being flowing through us as an instrument. But each of us can hinder that process if we choose to be sticky about things, if we choose to not keep our lives well oiled in his grace and in his truth. In fact, we're downright useless to him. He can play a few notes on us, so to speak. But if we are unbending and unwilling to move with the master's desire, we're of no good use to him, are we? This evening, in fact, for the next few weeks, I have the privilege of presenting to you one of the most interesting Bible characters to me, a man named David. Some of you looked at the bulletin this morning. It said, Pastor David, and it said, preaching on David, a boy who grew in humility. And they go, oh, that was really humble. And that wasn't about me. There was no better way to do that in the bulletin. Put it in quotes or something. I don't know. But if you will, take your Bibles and turn to 1 Samuel chapter 16. We're going to be talking about chapter 16 and 17 this evening. And I have more than 10 minutes tonight, and I am grateful for that. Just in case, though, I provided it all in a handout, and I was a little conservative in my printing. So if you didn't receive one and you'd like one, we'll have a few more next week available. My 18-point outline is found on the back of that handout, however, and I plan not to actually go through the principles learned from this as much as give you the main principle, the main meaning of this, or the main intent, I believe, of this particular passage. But David was a man after God's own heart. He was an instrument that God loved to play, if you'll let me use my illustration. He was a man, actually at this point that we're going to join David here, he's just a boy who's learning how to be pliable before the Lord, allowing the Lord to use the circumstances that God put him in order to develop character. If you really think about it, what is it that makes a good Christian? It's somebody who allows the good hand of God to put that person under different pressures and trials, hardship, sometimes just devastation, so that we can learn that he is good, that he is sufficient for every single need, that we can be content with him alone. That's the mark of a mature and a true Christian, a person who can trust and love the Lord. So as we look at David's life, let me just first remind you, in case you hadn't been here in a week or so ago, when we talked about the life of some of the other Old Testament saints here, but particularly Saul, You remember that Israel was not content with just allowing God to be their king. In fact, there were some threats on the horizon, and they asked Samuel to ask the Lord for a physical king. Do you remember what they said? In case you like flipping around, 1 Samuel chapter 8, around verse 19, he says, "Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, 'No, we will have a king over us, that we may also be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles.'" Remember that, because we're going to talk about Saul's relationship, or at least his role in the battle against the Philistines where Goliath shows up. And you remember that God actually had pretty much assessed the situation as, "Samuel, don't worry, it's not about you, it's about me. Israel's rejected me from being their protector, their king, their provider." And that's what's really interesting is in the book of 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel, you find the phrase, a new title being given for God out of all the Old Testament books prior to it. You don't find this particular title until 1 Samuel, and that is this unique title called Lord of Hosts. In fact, it occurs 10 times, and mainly what this particular phrase means is it's God of the armies. It refers to the myriad of angels who serve at his command. This title is a reference really to the fact that he has ultimate power and authority. He is the commander of everything. It's actually a reminder that Israel chose really a major downgrade when they asked for a human to be their king instead of the Lord of Hosts to guide them and to protect them against all the assailing enemies. And so, as we know, Saul had a minuscule character. He did some things right, but mainly he obeyed with half integrity. And finally, God said, "It is time for us to move forward with my plan." And so he said that he rejected Saul from being the king, and Samuel took it very hard. In fact, that's where we find Samuel in chapter 16 of 1 Samuel, verse 1. "Now the Lord said to Samuel, 'How long will you mourn for Saul, seeing I have rejected him from reigning over Israel?' Samuel was grieving, and God said to him, 'Fill your horn with oil and go. I am sending you to Jesse, the Bethlehemite, for I have provided myself a king among his sons.'" Samuel said, "How can I go? If Saul hears it, he'll kill me." A little background on that. Samuel was in Ramah. Saul was in Gibeah, which was just south of Ramah. And David lived in Bethlehem, which was south of Gibeah. In other words, for Samuel to go to the house of Jesse, the Bethlehemite, would mean that he would have to travel through the road that goes right past Saul's house, or Saul's main city, and Saul would be wondering what he was doing. And so, the Lord said, "Take a heifer with you and say, 'I have come to sacrifice to the Lord.' And then invite Jesse to that sacrifice, and I will show you then what you should do. You shall anoint for me the one I gave to you, I named to you." So Samuel did what the Lord said, and he went to Bethlehem. So the elders of the town trembled at his coming and said, "Do you come peaceably?" And he said, "Peaceably. I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. So sanctify yourselves and come with me to the sacrifice." Then he consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. So it was when they came that he, Samuel, looked at Eliab and said, "Surely the Lord's anointed is before him." But the Lord said to Samuel, "Do not look at his appearance or at the height of his stature, because I have refused him. For the Lord does not see as man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart." So Jesse called Abinadab and made him pass before Samuel. And he said, "Neither has the Lord chosen this one." Then Jesse made Shammah pass by, and he said, "Neither has the Lord chosen this one." Is the suspense building? Absolutely. I wonder what Samuel was thinking as the oldest went by, the second oldest went by, the third oldest went by. And Jesse made seven of his sons pass before Samuel. And Samuel said to Jesse, "The Lord has not chosen these." And Samuel said to Jesse, "Are all of the young men here?" In other words, have we overlooked someone here? And Samuel said, and Jesse said, "There remains yet the youngest, and there he is keeping the sheep." And Samuel said to Jesse, "Send him and bring him, for we will not sit down till he comes here." Isn't it ironic, isn't it interesting that David, the youngest son of Jesse, would be overlooked? Here, the one that God had decided to make the king of Israel was the one that was overlooked by the family in inviting to the sacrifice and to the anointing ceremony, which they were unaware of at that point when they were being invited to the sacrifice. David was overlooked. We have a little glimpse right now at what David's, what the situation that David grew up in. First of all, he was not treated as an equal among his brothers. It's very interesting. If he was, he would have been there. He would have been summoned from the hills of the Judean wilderness to come home and be there for that special sacrifice. He missed out. Any of us here ever been in a situation where our own family overlooked us for an event? You find out everybody got together, but you never heard about it? How'd that make you feel? Hurt. What was your reaction? Did you allow it to fester bitterness in you? We'll see if I ever do anything with them again. Or did you allow the Lord to administer a little bit of his oil, a little of his grace, in case you were feeling like you were getting a little sticky, using my illustration before with the French horn keys? We also get a little indication later in Samuel chapter 1 Samuel chapter 17. And I just want you to turn there real quick. 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 28. Watch how when David comes to the battle, and we'll go through the narrative, but I want to give you a little heads up here. When David is sent to the battle in order to actually bring a little lunch and some refreshments to his brothers by order of his father. Watch how the oldest brother treats David. Verse 28, "Now Eliab, the oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men, and Eliab's anger was aroused against David." He didn't say thank you, by the way, for the bread and the roasted barley. He just said this, "Why did you come down here? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your pride and the insolence of your heart, for you have come down to see the battle. You want to just see a fight." How insulting. Anybody ever been in that situation where your motives have been questioned? Ouch. What an insult. The few sheep that you're supposed to be watching, who took that job over? Why are you here? It seems as though David grew up in a very overlooked, hostile situation. Eighth of eight brothers. So if you'll turn right back to 1 Samuel chapter 16. Go back to verse 11. "So are all the young men here?" Well, actually there remains a youngest, but he's keeping the sheep, is what Jesse said. So Samuel said to Jesse, "Send him, send for him and bring him." In fact, we're not going to continue with the ceremony here until he arrives. And so verse 12, "So he sent him and brought him in. Now he was ruddy, with bright eyes, and good looking." It's kind of funny. Just a few verses ago, we find out the Lord does not see as man sees. The man looks for man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the inside of his heart. And then we have an actual description about David's physical appearances here. That's not contradictory. It's meant to put a little tongue in cheek into the humor here. So he's a good looking guy with bright eyes. And in fact, we know that he was at this age when this occurred. He was 12 years old. So the Lord said to him, arise and anoint him, for this is the one. Then Samuel took the horn of oil, anointed him in the midst of his brothers, and the Spirit of the Lord came upon David from that day forward. Isn't it interesting? We don't get David's name used or identified until verse 13. It's almost humorous that Samuel, in giving this account, overlooks David's name until verse 13. What's significant about this is, I'd love to have heard Samuel's reaction, but instead all we have here is, so Samuel arose and went back to Ramah, his hometown, just north of Bethlehem, Jerusalem, Gibeah, and there was Ramah. I wonder if Samuel was saying, Lord, do you know you just told me to anoint a little 12-year-old boy? Yes, he was a nice-looking boy, and he seemed pretty bright. He had eyes that, you know, he kept some eye contact when I talked with him. But Lord, he's a 12-year-old. You just fired King Saul. What's your plan here? Why did you choose? You know you chose a 12-year-old boy, right? He doesn't answer that. We don't have any discussion of that. But then what we find here is verse 14, but the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and a distressing spirit from the Lord troubled him. For the sake of time, we're just going to keep moving forward. I just want to give you the narrative, and then we're going to point out some important things. So Saul's servants then said to him, surely a distressing spirit from God is troubling you. Let our master now command your servants who are before you to seek out a man who will be skillful, who is a skillful player on the harp. It shall surely be that when he played it with his hand, that the distressing spirit from God is upon you, that you shall be well. So Saul said to his servants, provide me now a man who can play well and bring him to me. And then one of the servants answered and said, look, I have seen a son of Jesse, the Bethlehemite, who is skillful in playing. A mighty man of valor, actually we should say boy, a man of war, prudent in speech and handsome in person, and the Lord is with him. Isn't that interesting? How did this servant of Saul know about David? You know where David's main occupation was as a 12-year-old? Running errands for the family and hanging out in the wilderness and in the hill country of Judea. It's interesting, as insignificant as his role was in his family, people had observed him. Somebody here knew about David. They knew about his character. They knew about his relationship with the Lord. They knew about his abilities. And therefore, we have to conclude from that, no matter what situation in life we are, even if we think it's the most demeaning or the least influential type of a position that we have, whether you think it's something in your job, or whether you're a homemaker, or whether you're somebody that's stuck in some situation that you think is detestable, it doesn't matter, because people are watching you. And what's so interesting about this is, God was preparing David through the bad home life and through the situations that he experienced in the wilderness in order to be his man. And so we had asked before, what makes a good believer or a good Christian? It's a good God, but it's also a pliable instrument. And the key to that is, we need to be people who are willing to be submitted and yielded to God. I had asked somebody once, I had a relationship with some people when I was at Dallas Seminary. I knew Chuck Swindoll because I had the unique opportunity to be his waiter for his leadership luncheons as well as his presidential luncheons. And one day I just asked him, I said, how did you get into the position you are? How did you become the pastor you got to be? And he said to me something interesting. He said, when I had a ministry, just fresh out of seminary, I had a ministry up in New England area, and he said, it went miserably. All the stuff I learned at seminary, I tried to apply, but everything just seemed to fall flat on its face. And I really had a tough time before the Lord. It was a trying, testing time where I had to seek Him, and I really had to start from square one and say, Lord, what did I do wrong? Where do I go? Do you want me to quit this? Show me what you want. This is an exact quote, but those are the gist of the things I remember taking from the conversation. And he said, you know what? He said, any man of leadership, any true believer that God matures is a person who God has to kind of rebuild from square one and put in a hardship situation. And the person that endures from that and yields and submits their heart to the Lord in that process is somebody that the Lord then can use for His ministry. And what David represents is somebody who is in a miserable home life situation, and then he ended up learning the lessons that God wanted him to learn, so that when it came time for God's plan to move forward, David was ready, because he had done all the menial tasks faithfully, and he had learned the lessons, and most of all, he learned that God was trustworthy, and that God was sovereign, and that He was a good God, and that He would watch over him, and that He would give him the strength and the power and the wisdom to meet every situation while he was doing what? Tending stupid little sheep. It's interesting, when you turn over back to 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 34 and verse 35, David's talking to Saul, because Saul told him, Saul told him when David came to him and said, I want to go out and battle with Goliath. Saul said, no, you're not going to be able to go against this Philistine. You're just a boy. You're a youth. But he's a man of war from his youth. But David said to Saul this, your servant used to keep his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and took a lamb out of the flock, I went out after it and struck it and delivered the lamb from its mouth. And when it rose against me, I caught it by its beard and struck it and killed it. Your servant has killed both lion and bear. So this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing that he has defied the armies of the living God. What's so interesting about that is, if it were me and a bear were to snatch little Fluffy or whatever from the leash out in the backyard, I'd say, oh, that's too bad. I'm not going after that dog. But David saw his role before his family as, I have to guard these sheep. I have to be the right kind of shepherd. Even though nobody was watching in the wilderness, even though his dad probably would have even understood and have agreed that, yes, David, that was a scary situation. If a bear and or a lion has done that to you, I understand you've lost a few this week. That's too bad. But instead, David took his job, his menial little flock, very seriously. And so what I want to encourage you tonight is, regardless of whatever situation God has put you in, whether you think that you are in a place where you can't affect anyone, or you are just miserable with the situation of life, recognize this. If you submit to where He's put you, and you learn who He is in those situations, and you allow Him to shape your heart, and you follow after Him wholeheartedly in those situations, you will be the person He needs you to be when He wants you to be picked up and played for His glory. See, David did that. If you just go back real quick to 1 Samuel 16, verse 19, therefore Saul sent messengers to Jesse and said, please, or send me your son David who is with the sheep. So Jesse took a donkey loaded with bread, a skin of wine, a young goat, and sent them by his son David to Saul. It's possible he was just providing the next meal for David. It's another possibility that he was giving a gift of sorts to Saul. Regardless, verse 21, so David came to Saul and stood before him, and notice this, and he, Saul, loved him greatly, and David became his armor bearer. We don't know how much time elapsed, but in the relationship that they had, Saul got attached to David. And you know why?
because David had proven himself to be a man of integrity. He had proven himself to be a man of wisdom and prudent speech. He had proven himself also to be somebody that the Lord is with. And when the Lord, that is the Spirit of God, resides in us, you know what should be flowing out of us? All of a sudden I'm blanking on the fruits of the Spirit. Oh, patience, gentleness, kindness, self-control, goodness, mercy. The things that are of God's heart. David was an enjoyable person to be around because he submitted to God. And because of that also, he walked with integrity. And because of that, the Spirit was allowed to manifest his fruits within David. And so David was exalted then. Isn't it interesting how God put him in the right places at the right time? So then, so it was that the verse 22, Saul said to Jesse, saying, "Please let David stand before me, for he's found favor in my sight. I want to hire him on more or less, is the meaning of what's going on there. And so it was, whenever the Spirit from God was upon Saul, that David would take a harp and play it with his hand. Then Saul would become refreshed and well, and the distressing spirit would depart from him." 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 1. "Now the Philistines gathered their armies together to battle. They were gathered at Succoth, which belongs to Judah. They encamped between Succoth and Azekah in Ephnasdamim, and Saul and his men of Israel were gathered together, and they camped in the valley of Elah, and drew up in battle array against the Philistines. The Philistines stood on a mountain on one side. The Israelites stood on a mountain on the other side, with the valley between them. And a champion went out from the camp of the Philistines, named Goliath, from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits in a span, that is 9 feet and 9 inches tall, about the height of a basketball hoop or some of the ceilings in your houses. And he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of that coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze, that is 126 or 125 pounds. He had he had bronze armor on his legs, a bronze javelin, some other translations say scimitar, a sword that was mighty scary looking, between his shoulders. Now the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his iron spear had weighed 600 shekels, that is, the tip of his spear weighed 15 pounds. Can you imagine the shaft of that spear? And then it says, a shield bearer went before him. This man was invincible. He was a walking tank. And he would come down from the high ground that the Philistines held, and he would say this. He stood out and cried to the armies of Israel and said, "Why have you come out to line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and you the servants of Saul?" In other words, it's possible he's contrasting his freedom in being the mighty Philistine and there having to be under the bondage of Saul's leadership. I don't know. "But choose for a man yourselves and let him come down to me. And if he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you all," is the meaning, you shall be our servants and serve us." A ton was at risk. And this was a common practice for sometimes especially for land disputes and some other reasons. People would have these matches done by champions who would represent the rest of the people that they were with. But never had the stakes been so high for actually the Philistines against the Israelites, so that if whichever one won, the other would submit to the rulership of the other nation. So the Philistine said, "I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." He's trying to demoralize them. He's trying to poke them on. "And when Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistines, they were dismayed and greatly afraid." I would encourage you, if you ever study this particular passage, study fear. You'll find, in fact, if you study fear through the book of 1 Samuel, you find Saul hiding in the baggage. You find Saul hiding right now, or at least right now, just staying with the rest of Israel. And you find dreadful fear going from later when Goliath comes down again. But then when you watch David come, there's no fear. There's only his his solid surety in the Lord. But watch this. You remember how we had read the passage in 1 Samuel 8 where the people had said, we want a king who will be a judge for us and go out before us and fight our battles. And so who did they pick? They picked Israel's tallest, most mighty-looking man, Saul. And where is that tallest man, the giant among the Israelites? He is sitting with the rest of the Israelites, dismayed and greatly afraid. What God had called him to do was to lead the people of Israel. But he even was given this Holy Spirit, it says. And yet he didn't. What's the difference? I would encourage you, do a study on the life of Saul and do a study on the life of David. One is found while he's trying to track down some donkeys, being faithful to his father's commands. Another is watching the sheep, being faithful to his father's commands. In fact, they both grow up in very humble means. They look like the same type of individuals until they both have power. And they both sin. But the difference is how they respond to their sin. Saul made excuses. And Saul continued to sin. David, however, when he was confronted by Nathan and Gad, the two prophets that God sent to him to humble him, David responded. That's the key. And so as we talk tonight and as we look at the life of David, I want to ask you, what can God do with you? I'm not talking about where is he going to send you, what is he going to do with you, but really, how much control can he even have in your life? Are you somebody that makes excuses? Are you somebody that is constantly hiding in your own fear or your sick self-pity that sometimes manifests itself really it's pride that's manifesting itself in self-pity? Are you somebody that constantly is avoiding time with the Lord? Or are you somebody that when you hear something and your conscience is pricked, whether it's something that's said on a Sunday morning or something that's said in conversation or something you hear on the radio, do you immediately confess before the Lord? That is the type of person that David learned how to be while he was tending flocks. Because then God could use that kind of a boy. Let's keep going real quick here. So when Saul and all Israel heard these words, they were dismayed. Now verse 12, David was the son of that Ephrathite of Bethlehem of Judah, whose name was Jesse. He had 8 sons, and the man was old, advanced in years in the days of Saul. That is, David's dad was an elderly individual. So the 3 oldest sons of Jesse had gone to follow Saul in the battle, so they were military men. The names of his 3 sons who went to battle were Eliab, the firstborn, next to him, Abinadab, the 3rd, Shammah. And David was the youngest. By the way, according to most of all the commentaries here, at this point, 5 years had passed. In fact, David is 17 years old at this point. And the 3 oldest followed Saul. But David occasionally went and returned from Saul. Remember, he was Saul's armor bearer and music player to administer to music to his soul and calm him down. But he returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. And the Philistines drew near and presented himself 40 days, morning and evening. And Jesse said to his son David, take now for your brothers an ephah of this dried grain and these 10 loaves and run to your brothers at the camp and carry these 10 cheeses to the captain of their 1,000 and see how your brothers fare and bring me back news of them. So now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting the Philistines. This is 15 miles right from Bethlehem. This was in David's back door. And the fact that the Philistines had gone up the valley of Elah, which was a major route to get to the Israelite cities in the hill country, was a significant thing. This is dangerous stuff. The battle is critical because if the Philistines are actually able to take this valley, then all the cities in the hill country of Judah are going to be taken. So David rose early in the morning, left the sheep with the keeper, took the things, and went as Jesse had commanded him. He came to the camp as the army was going out to fight and shout for the battle. It's interesting that David came at the exact moment that he could hear what Goliath is saying, when the armies were heading out for the morning, it seems. It's no coincidence. It's interesting, though David is just following his dad's orders, God is directing his path in a perfectly timed, orchestrated event here. So David left the supplies, that is all the stuff he brought, in the hands of the supply keeper or the guard, ran to the army and came, and he greeted his brothers. I wonder what the greeting from them was like. As he talked with them, there was a champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, coming out of the armies of the Philistines, and he spoke according to the same words we heard. So David heard them. And all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were dreadfully afraid. What a miserable 40 days those must have been like. So the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who's come up? Certainly he has come to defy Israel, and it shall be that the man who kills him, the king, will enrich with great riches, give him his daughter, give his father's house exemption from the taxes of Israel." And then David spoke to the men who stood by him, saying, "What shall be done for the men who kills the Philistines and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" Notice what David's focus is on. The dishonor that's being given to God. Not that the whole country of Israel might actually, or particularly Judah at this point, might be taken over. But he's actually concerned about a bigger thing, and that is God's reputation. What a significant thing. He asks this, and he asks this. We had read the passage here where Eliab hears him asking these questions. He rebukes him, and David says, "What have I done now? Can't I say anything?" That's kind of the meaning of the Hebrew text. You can hear the brotherly banter going on between these guys. And he asks other people this in verse 30. But I want to get to this next section, which is key. "Now when the words of David, which were spoken, were heard and reported back to Saul, Saul sent for him. David said to Saul," he said, "Let no man's heart fail because of him, for your servant will go and fight with this Philistine." Saul said, "No, you're not able to fight against this Philistine. You're a boy, you're a youth, and this is a great warrior." But David said to Saul, "Your servants used to," we already read this part, "but you know, I used to take care of the sheep. I've rescued them. I have practice in this. I can do it." And then he said in verse 37, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion, from the paw of the bear, will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." David recognized that in all the stuff he's had to experience in the past, it was the Lord who was behind it all. He purposely kept that in mind. That is what motivated him. As you do a study on David, what you find is this man, this boy at this point, he understood that God was his protector, his provider. He was keenly interested and had a plan for his life. And folks, as Christians, we have been given the same thing now that we have come under the covenant of Jesus Christ. He promises to protect us. He promises to provide for every need. He, in fact, invites us to approach the throne of God boldly and to ask for anything in his name, because it delights the Father. If we love the Son and we have this relationship with the Son, Jesus said, "My Father will do anything for you." We have been given that type of a relationship, and we've been even given the same thing. The unique thing of the Old Testament was when the Holy Spirit of God would come upon a man, we have that unique, unique gift from God, and we don't even recognize it. We take that for granted. I would encourage you to consider how well endowed we are by God to do the tasks at hand. He has given us everything we need to accomplish what he wants us to do in this life. And that is for us to represent him well, to be faithful, to live in integrity, and particularly to be proclaiming the goodness of his Son and the perfect plan that he has to redeem mankind so that he might reestablish a relationship with all who are lost. We have no excuse for fear. We have no excuse to say that we can't live lives that are not dominated by sin, because David demonstrated, even in the Old Testament, that with the Holy Spirit's power and with a willing, submitted heart, he was able to live a life of integrity before God. We have no excuse. And I would like to encourage you, if you have my handout, to read some of the applications on the back of the handout. But that's the main one that I wanted to get to tonight. We need to be cultivating a heart of humility, of moldability, so to speak, that God can mold and change our hearts in whatever situation that he's put us in is perfect. And it's designed, believe it or not, for you, as terrible as it may be, so that you might be able to trust him and to learn that he is good, that he is trustworthy, and he will be your deliverer. Submit to that, and then watch what he does. You know what's missing from this passage? David ever praying, get me out of this house. Get me out of the job of a servant. Make me king like you promised you would back 5 years ago. No, he was just faithful to God in whatever situation God put him in. He is good. God is very good. And if you submit to his heavy hand, you will find that it is actually a beautifully light hand that wants to pick you up and to breathe life and grace through you, that you might then administer it to the world and be an instrument of his.